Just in case you haven't turned to Luke chapter 21, I would like you to do that. So as we go through here, we'll be able to spend a little bit of time looking at some of the details here. We're talking about a section here of what is known as the Olivet Discourse, one of Jesus' sort of lengthy sermons, I guess, or as it's called, a discourse, a discussion about the last things. Some of that is a little mysterious to us. Some of what he says is, in some ways, controversial, only because I think we misunderstand it. But I think what he wants Christians to do as a result of his discussion is not so mysterious. We are simply called upon to endure. And I'd like to take a look at some of what he says here today and maybe kind of ferret out the mysterious from the non-mysterious, so that we can at least have an understanding of what Jesus is calling us to do today. Let's talk for just a few moments about the signs that Jesus has, that he mentions here. And this perhaps is a little bit of the mysterious part, although I'm not convinced it's so much mysterious as much as we've made it very mysterious. One of the things I think we have to realize is a lot of what he says here is contemporaneous with Jesus himself. All of the things that Jesus says here can't be way in the future. Now, there may be some parallels of what happens in the future, but I believe he's talking about things specifically that are going to happen to the disciples in that day. And here's why I say that. What is the question that is asked of Jesus in this passage? Less a question as much as an observation that he makes. And he says, while some were speaking of the temple, how it was adorned with noble stones and offerings, he said, and he makes a comment about those things. Okay? They're all walking around, man, isn't this a beautiful place? Isn't this a wonderful place of worship? Isn't this a great testament to God's presence among us? Perhaps is some of the things they may have been saying. And so Jesus says, well, guess what? None of this is going to remain very long. It's all going to be thrown down, trampled underfoot. And so the disciples ask a question, well, when's that going to happen? What will be the sign when these things are about to take place? That's the question Jesus is answering here. And so I would say, and a lot of people would agree with this, the question is about something that's going to happen in their day. That has to have meaning for them, for him to answer this question. That's got to have meaning for the question they ask. And so it is quite likely that what he's talking about is the destruction of the temple, which happened, we know, around AD 70, or sometime within a couple of years of that, I believe. The rebellion started around AD 70, I believe, is what happened. Rebellion of the Jews against Rome. And they came in and they destroyed the temple and they destroyed the city. You know, eventually, that's what Jesus is talking about here. His warnings had to have some direct implications for his listeners. Otherwise, the question would be meaningless. The words can't all refer to future events. Now, admittedly, some of what he says here does sound that way, and we'll try to at least kind of play with that just a little bit and see what we can make of it. One of the things that we see Jesus says here, and we didn't read this section, but in verse 30, it becomes very clear that the kingdom is near. You remember when Jesus started his ministry? That's one of the things he said. The kingdom is near. It's about to happen. It's about to break in on the world. And if you jump down to verses 29 through 31, actually through 32, he told them a parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. As soon as they come out in leaf, you see for yourselves and know that summer is already near. So also, when you see these things taking place, these things being all the things he's just described to them, you know that the kingdom of God is near. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all has taken place. And I have to tell you that all this business about the last days and about all the, you know, when Jesus is coming back and the belief that it's happening today, part of it revolves around what does he mean by this generation? Is the generation 25 years? Is the generation 40 years? Is the generation 100 years? Biblical scholars have been debating that for years and years and years. Maybe generations. They've been trying to figure that one out. How long is a generation? Well, if we have to try to understand what he means by this generation, it seems to me that in the context, he's talking about present day. Not present day today, but present day then, when he's speaking. This generation will not pass away until all has taken place. That's the way I understand it. It seems to me it does violence to the context to think about it as a generation, meaning sometime 2,000 years later. How he's using all the language in here gets a little bit complicated for us because we don't understand the language that he uses. But I believe he's talking about his own day. All of what he's talking about has to take place during the time in which he's talking about it and the time in which those who hear him understand that it's going to be soon. It's going to be happening, you know, pretty quickly. What all these things mean might be a little bit perplexing to us, especially when we look at, say, verses 25 through 28. And there will be sign and sun and moon and stars and the earth and on the earth, distress of nations in perplexity because of the roaring of the sea and the waves. People fainting with fear and with foreboding of what is coming on the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Well, that sure sounds like the second coming to us, doesn't it? Now, when these things begin to take place, straighten up and raise your heads because your redemption is drawing near. Well, I have to tell you, there's another way perhaps we can look at this. But let's first go to Acts chapter 1 and verse 11. Let's take a look at what he says there. If there's any clear discussion about what's going to happen when Jesus comes back and what it's going to look like, this has got to be it. The disciples have just seen Jesus leave. He's been ascended into heaven, raised through the clouds, and he's disappeared beyond their sight. And then two angels, what they say, men in white, we assume they're angels, stand before them, and they say this in verse 11, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into heaven? This Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven." It's pretty clear there's no symbolic language there. They're not talking, it seems to me, about some sort of thing that's not going to happen exactly the way they describe it. They've just seen Jesus raised up. That's the way he's going to come back. That's kind of what we're waiting for. That seems to be the language that is used back in Luke chapter 21 and verse 27. That's what it sounds like to us, at least. But let me make a suggestion to you here that the language Jesus is using about the signs and the sun, the moon and the stars, etc., etc., that's language that is often used by the prophets simply to refer to the fact that everything cosmic is going to be kind of shaken up. What those particular signs are, I'm not sure that we know. Other than perhaps what they're using is language just sort of by way of a metaphor, by way of simply, look, God's turning everything upside down. And if you go back sometime and read, in fact, let's go back to the book of Joel. That's part of our reading for this week that I put in the worship bulletin. Once you look at Joel chapter 2, verses 30 through 32. Now, just note without reading it that verses 28 and 29 are what Peter uses to describe what's happening on the day of Pentecost. Okay? Peter gives that a very specific and concrete reference point. But then Joel goes on to say, "And I will show wonders in the heavens and on the earth, blood and fire and columns of smoke. The sun will be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes." What I simply want to suggest to you is what Jesus is adopting here is some very strong prophetic language about the universe and about everything within the universe sort of being shaken up. Will there literally be blood on the moon when the Lord comes back? I'm not so sure that's what's intended, but it's certainly going to represent some sort of cosmic upheaval, isn't it? When that kind of thing happens. And that's really what Jesus is talking about. Jesus may simply be alluding to the fact that things are changing. Now, he gives some very specific signs in some of this portion here. But my suggestion is simply that it all has to have some sort of reference point to the disciples in those days. That's the kind of mysterious part, and we want to sort of bring it all forward and make it all apply to us today, these wars and rumors of wars and stuff. And you know, I'll be the first one to admit that could very well be the case. But let's talk about the things maybe that aren't so mysterious here. And maybe there's some of this we can at least take away for ourselves today that may help us. I think the thing that we take away from this, among other things, is simply the fact Jesus says, don't be deceived and don't be led astray by any kind of false messiahs. There's nothing mysterious about that. He says in verse 9, first of all, the end's not going to be at once. Whatever Jesus is talking about to his disciples, they're being told they're going to have to endure some things for a while. And he says in verse 8, number one, false messiahs will come. People claiming to be offers of salvation. And Jesus says, nope, don't listen to them. He seems to have in mind some very specific things here, but the fact is, we're always living in a time when the world is offering us other ways of salvation, aren't we? We're always living in those times. There are always going to be people trying to say, no, don't worry about Jesus, this Jesus guy. There's always some other way of salvation. Don't be deceived by those things. He says in verse 10, nations will be in turmoil. He says in verse 11, nature itself seems to be in turmoil. And one of the questions that I keep coming back to today is, okay, people take this and they say, this means today. Nation rising against nation, wars and rumors of wars. We're always hearing about those things. We're always hearing about earthquakes. We're always hearing about, you know, hurricanes and things that are disrupting nature. My question has always been this. How do we know that today there are more of those things than there were in the first century or the second century or the third century? Did they keep records of those things? I'm unaware of just how many of those kinds of records we have, of those kind of ancient writings, those sort of ancient weather reports, for example. We don't know that there are more of those things now than there were in the first century. And that's the problem with interpreting all this as this is all present day. I'll be the first one to admit it could be. It just might be that Jesus is coming soon. You know, we just sang. Jesus has always been coming soon. That's the problem that we have. We don't understand the word soon in God's language. But the fact is, we're told simply, just be ready. You're going to have to endure. And then he goes on to tell them about, you know, specific things that they have to be ready for. Number one, actually, down in verse 34, he says, don't be weighed down. Not only does he say, don't be deceived, but then he says in verse 34 and following, don't be weighed down by all these several other things. Dissipation is the word that my translation uses. I don't know what the NIV says, but dissipation means simply to indulge in an extravagant pursuit of pleasure. He says, don't be weighed down by drunkenness. It's always fascinating to me how long that's been around. you know, go back and some of the prophets will talk about it as well. They even, I think it's in Isaiah where he criticizes those who have become champions at mixing drinks. You know, even back in Isaiah's day, they had people who were, great mixers of drinks. Why that seems to be something that people can brag about, I have no clue. But the fact is, alcoholism has always been with us. People who are being swayed by having that and wanting to do that and wanting to feel that and wanting to just, you know, be very much, that's their lifestyle. They drink. Perhaps that kind of thing, maybe that's the one thing that best symbolizes the lifestyle of partying and lack of self-discipline. Drunkenness. It's just always associated with that, isn't it? He talks about not being weighed down also by the cares of life. That's a very interesting one to me. Go back and read the parable of the sower and look at the third soil. The third soil, the thorns that choked out the plant, one of the things that choked out the plant was the cares of life. All of those things that we worry about, all of those things that kind of weigh us down, cause us anxiety, maybe legitimate things, but they become burdens to us and they weigh us down. He also says in this section that, you know, people are unaware that, how does he say it here? Mine says, and that day come upon you suddenly like a trap. Which is basically the same as saying he's going to come like a thief in the night. And we've seen that image numerous times before. The warnings that he gives us here are relevant for any age. They transcend that day, and they're relevant for the second century. They're relevant for the first millennium. They're relevant for the second millennium. They're relevant for the third millennium. They're always relevant for us, those particular things. Jesus says you have to endure and conquer. Verse 19 of chapter 21. By your endurance, you will gain your lives. Now again, specifically, he's referring to them in that day, but he did tell them in verse 9, did he not, that the end would not be at once? And he has described there that they have to suffer persecution, and they're going to have to give their testimony. Seems to me, the things he describes here, he kind of gets pretty specific. You know, it seems to me it's specific enough that we believe he's really talking about very particular things in there. They're going to be dragged before governors and so forth. And you know, they're going to be dragged into the synagogues. I don't know about any of us going to be dragged into any synagogue to testify. But the fact is, they would be dragged into synagogues. The notion, however, of persecution and suffering is certainly inherent in any age of Christian living. Take a look at 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 12. Paul says to Timothy, in the context, by the way, of endurance and patience, he says, indeed, all who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. You're going to stand out. You're not going to go along with the ways of the world. You've got a whole different viewpoint about the world and what you're hoping for and what you're living for. And the world, for the most part, cannot tolerate that. You kind of have to toe the line in society. Otherwise, you're going to be seen as somewhat of an outcast. And I've always liked what the Spirit says, the Spirit basically being Jesus himself. But in the book of Revelation, chapters 2 and 3, I just want to point out just a couple of them. I want you to go back and look at them later. But in Revelation chapters 2 and 3, he speaks to specific churches in Asia. He says the same thing to them at the end of each little discourse to each church. He basically says the same thing. He says to the one who conquers, chapter 2 verse 7, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I will grant to eat at the tree of life. Verse 11, when he speaks to the church in Smyrna, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. Verse 17, to the one who conquers. Verse 26, to the one who conquers. Chapter 3, verse 5, 12, and 21, to the one who conquers. Every one of them, you see, has something implied about the need to endure, the need to fight, the need to kind of stay strong. Endurance, conquering. That's the part that's not so mysterious to us. When Jesus is coming back, what all those signs mean, that may be a little mysterious to us. It may mean we struggle with trying to understand the signs that Jesus says we should look for. Maybe it means those signs will just sort of continue. Maybe there'll just be signs like that all the time. And maybe those things are warnings for us simply that we have to endure. Does it mean we know exactly what day and time period Jesus is coming back? I just don't see that. And if you go back and you look at Christian history for 2,000 years, people have been trying to do it for 2,000 years, and they failed every time. Now, there's a guy on the radio now that you can turn him on at night, and I think it's May or April 8th or something of next year Jesus is supposed to come back. It's like, okay, what is it?
May 21st.
May 21st, okay. I'm glad you told me. I have to write that down and make sure I know exactly when that's going to be. Okay. You know, people have been doing that for 2,000 years. He's going to come back this day. It just hasn't happened that way. When are we going to learn? Just endure. Let me show you one other passage and we'll end here. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, First and Second Thessalonians are the two letters in the New Testament which probably more clearly than any other letters talk about the second coming of Christ. Here in chapter 3 of the second letter, the Apostle Paul is simply giving some advice of those who are concerned about the second coming. They're waiting for the second coming. And what does he say to them? What things does he say that they should do in order to simply be ready? Well, in verses 6 and following, I'm just gonna summarize it a little bit for you. Actually, in verses 10 and 12 is where he says simply, be busy. Don't be lazy. Do your work. No need to sit around and wait for it to happen, because your waiting isn't going to make it happen any more than, you know, a watched pot doesn't boil. You know, you're watching it isn't going to make it happen anymore or any more quickly. He says in verse 13, don't get tired of doing good things. Now again, these are people that have been asking questions about the second coming, about what should they do. Some of them, it seems, are just sort of sitting around waiting for it to happen because they think it's going to happen soon. And in a way, it is going to happen soon. See, it's always soon, which is part of the mystery of it. What does God mean by soon? It does take a certain amount of self-control and endurance to keep doing good, doesn't it? When you don't seem to get any return on it, or you don't see it happening, you don't see signs that Jesus, in fact, is coming back. But that's what Paul says. Just keep doing good. Now, Peter sounds a very similar warning in 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 through 15, and I'll leave that for your reading for later on, but he really says three things there that are important. Number one is be patient. Number two is continue to work. Same as what Paul's telling the Thessalonians here. And finally, live a life of holiness. You know what? In a way, it doesn't really matter when Jesus is coming back. Those things are still important, because it's sort of always imminent. I don't even think, from what I understand, that Jesus himself said even he didn't know exactly when he was supposed to come back, at least till he got up to the at the right hand of God and back to God again. He didn't know. If he did, he didn't let on. Just be ready. These things are good for today's Christians as much as they were for the first century Christians. Let us resolve in our hearts that even if we don't fully understand the signs and the things Jesus is talking about, these things we do know. And let's focus on them, concentrate on doing them. Floyd, let's stand and sing our song of encouragement.